Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Government interruptus continuous. Ladies and gentlemen, I failed Latin, but even I know that that's bad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 7th of October, which is also conveniently the 7th day of the Great Government Shutdown of 2013. If you've been keeping track, you know there are two things going on right now. The shutdown for one, the debt limit for another one. Come October the 17th or so, the government's not going to be able to pay all its bills. Now, the U.S. pays lots of bills, millions of them every single day. And there has been talk lately of prioritizing, paying some folks, like those to whom we owe interest on our debt, ahead of others. But when you look at the sheer quantity of bills the Treasury Department pays on any given day, you learn quickly that's a whole lot easier said than done. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going today.
How about we take Tuesday, October 1st, for example? That was the first day of the government shutdown. There were payments to federal workers worth $755 million. There were payments to defense contractors worth about $964 million. Well, these figures come from a Treasury Department spreadsheet, a very dense Treasury Department spreadsheet. I asked Lauren Adler to help us make sense of it. He works with the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
On that day, we also have an almost $4 billion payment to military active duty members. In addition, there's also a big retirement payment that goes out to both federal civilian and military retirees of about $9 billion.
Now, remember, we're not talking about a single $4 billion check here. There are more than 1.4 million men and women on active duty. That's more than 1.4 million checks.
Remember, Treasury does, on average, 3 to 5 million transactions a day.
Steve Bell works for the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Now, that's impossible for any one human being to do. So what they do, essentially, is computer to computer.
All these payments are automated, and that, Bell says, is what would make prioritization so difficult.
Right now, I would say it would be impossible, logistically impossible, for Treasury in any quick time to change the present system.
On top of the fact that time is running out, Bell says the Treasury Department is working with computers that are not state-of-the-art. And don't forget, 80% of the department's employees have been furloughed. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
That spreadsheet with all the payments on it that David was talking about, it's up on our website. If you want to take a look for yourself, punish yourself, I guess. It's marketplace.org. Out on the receiving end of those payments, by the way, besides the retirees and active duty military and big giant defense contractors, are hundreds or more likely thousands of small businesses. The Delaware Steel Company out of Fort Washington, Pennsylvania is one of them. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of that company. Lisa, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai. I'm glad to be here.
What's it like for you, Lisa, with your biggest customer now out of business, I imagine?
With the shutdown, orders can't come in. There's no one to fill out the paperwork. There's no one to place the orders. So it's taking a slow system and slowing it down even more.
Explain to me how it works. You get a request for a proposal from the government and you give them a quote back? Is that...
Yeah, generally it works like that. Most of my accounts are people who are actually doing the government work. So they call me, not the government itself. And so, for example, we've been working on an order, about a $125,000, $150,000 order. Mm-hmm. And then on Friday, a terrific customer said, all right, it's a deal. I'll get you the paperwork on Monday. Because when they came in on Monday, they expected the paperwork from their government. However, there was no paperwork that came. So now I don't have the order, they don't have the order, and the person who actually does the work also doesn't have the order. The truckers who move the steel, nobody has the order.
But what happens then, Lisa, when the government does eventually open up, as it will in theory do? Are you going to be able to bounce right back? I mean, these orders are ready to go and boom, or no?
No, of course not. There's a ramping up, so things take a while. This is a big economy, so if we're just looking at my small business, you know, it'll take us a few hours, and then you dispatch the trucks, and then the trucks go in. Well, they were already scheduled to do all that, so now everybody said, hurry up and stop. Now, hopefully in a week or two or three, we're going to come in and we're going to say, hurry up again. So sure, you ramp up and you make up time, but how about the other orders that now didn't come in?
Right.
So you can't make up for lost time. It sounds so trite, but it's very, very true.
What are your crews, what are your folks saying in the break room as you walk by, whenever they get a coffee break or whatever? What are they saying?
It's interesting, Kai. They're really not talking about steel per se. What they're saying is it doesn't feel fair. They're all just sort of making it, or their brother-in-law's out of a job, or their sister-in-law's just barely paying the rent. And if those people are sent home without pay, it feels unfair because it has nothing to do with the work they're doing. They struggle to get the jobs. They struggle to keep the jobs. And now they're theoretically doing a good job and yet sent home, not for poor performance, not for anything other than things that have nothing to do with the worker. And they're angry and they're frustrated because they don't know how to affect change in their day-to-day lives. Hmm. It's like being held hostage, to be perfectly honest. That's how it feels to me, and that's what my employees are saying. It's a hostage crisis. It's not a government shutdown.
Lisa Goldenberg is the president of Delaware Steel Company. That's in Pennsylvania. She is also the president of the Association of Steel Distributors. Lisa, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Started low, ended low on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, when we get there. There was some rare international praise for Syria today. The government there has started destroying its chemical weapons, which Secretary of State John Kerry called a good beginning. He also said the Assad regime deserves credit for living up to its end of the bargain. All the while, the fighting on the ground continues, of course. But outside Syria, exiles are waging their own propaganda battles with Assad and his proxies. Those fights are nonviolent, but they're not quick and they're not cheap, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Well, this is North Acton. A number of Syrian families live in this area. It's something of a hub for the Syrian community.
Malik al-Abder is one of several hundred British Syrians who've settled in this rather drab London suburb. Not all of them are opposition activists like Malik. Indeed, he says that living just across the road from him is the Syrian dictator's father-in-law.
It's quite a modest house. It's the one here with the satellite dish. Nothing special, I suppose.
I expect he's not your favourite neighbour.
No, not particularly. I mean, we used to say hello, as good neighbours, but not anymore. His failure to condemn what his son-in-law is doing in Syria, I think for me, was just something completely unethical.
Having Assad's father-in-law as a neighbour is all the more extraordinary since Malik has been a scourge of the Syrian regime as editor of an opposition satellite TV channel. Based in London, Barada TV began broadcasting into Syria long before the Arab Spring. Malik thinks it helped fuel a national craving for freedom and democracy.
Since the revolution began, I met many Syrians from inside the country who would admit, they would say, we used to close the doors, close the windows and switch on and watch Barada TV because it was the only TV channel that said the truth.
But 2 years ago, Barada TV's credibility was seriously questioned. WikiLeaks revealed that most of its funding came from the US State Department. Malik, however, does not feel compromised.
In fact, I would argue that had the channel been funded by a Syrian businessman or an Arab country like Saudi Arabia or Qatar, its credibility would probably be a lot more undermined than the fact that it was funded by the US. I think the US had a very hands-off approach towards Barada TV.
It's academic now. He quit the channel in a row over censorship with his Syrian managers, and the channel folded at the end of last year when its American funding was cut. If it's any consolation for people like Malik, the pro-Assad campaign in London is also feeling the pinch. These days, there are fewer protests like this one in favour of Assad. Some British Syrians who support the regime and oppose the uprising say they can't afford to take any more time off work to demonstrate. Amar Wakaf is an exception.
Being sort of self-employed rather than having a permanent job, this gives you the luxury of being able to dedicate man hours to follow the issue.
Amar, who runs a small management consultancy here, devotes three-quarters of his working life to a cause that's highly unpopular in Britain, keeping Assad in power.
Are you receiving any money from the Syrian government? Are you in the pay of the Syrian government?
No, not at all. This is not something that I want to feel I'm paid for.
Amar gives interviews and takes part in debates, putting the case in Britain for the Assad regime. He says he's speaking up for millions of his compatriots back in Syria who don't want to see the regime, in spite of its many failings, overthrown.
The government is still on its feet, and we're talking about millions and millions of people who go to their daily work, keeping the economy afloat, keeping the government afloat. Do they want democracy? Of course they do. Do they want less corruption, less dictatorship? Of course they do. But there are other issues on their mind.
And uppermost, he says, is the fear that the uprising may turn Syria into a failed state dominated by al-Qaeda. The propaganda war in London continues. Both sides seem to accept it will be a long war of attrition and a costly one. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
If you're an advertiser and you want to buy time on a TV show, you're going to head to one place first. Nielsen, the ratings and data collecting people. Which shows are popular with single men between the ages of 18 and 35? Nielsen. What are married women with kids watching? Nielsen. Which shows are people tweeting about as of today? Also, Nielsen. Marketplace's Quina Kim reports it's all about trying to capture that most elusive metric of all, buzz.
The ultimate goal of advertising is to get you to buy stuff. But that takes buzz. Rebecca Lieb is an analyst at the Altimeter Group.
It's probably never happened in history that somebody's seen a commercial for a car and said, bingo, that's the car for me. I'm going out to buy it.
She says the best a commercial can do is to start the conversation. You do research, you talk to friends and colleagues, and hopefully one of them will say, well, no, I don't have a VW, but did you see the Super Bowl ad? It was sweet. For much of advertising history, that conversation has been almost impossible to measure. Twitter claims to have a solution, and it got a boost from Nielsen today, which started offering advertisers data on which TV shows people are tweeting or buzzing about. Brian Weiser is an analyst at Pivotal Research.
Twitter might at least provide some benchmarks, because it's really hard to set up listening stations around the country at water coolers, although maybe the NSA may have some views on how to do that.
The idea is that if you're an advertiser who wants buzz, then you pick shows that get buzz. But there's a limit on how much you can learn. Nielsen counts how many tweets are sent, but not how many are read. And Weiser says TV shows have yet to prove that tweets translate into more viewers. Chandra Hill is a professor at the Wharton School. She says that won't keep Twitter from making money off all those tweets anyways.
The data can be used to get insights into what consumers, in particular of brands and TV shows, think.
And selling that data is proving to be a lucrative side business for Twitter. In its IPO filing, it said it made $47.5 million off of it. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
what we can start in a small way in one country has a value and has a concrete application in many other countries, rich countries and poor countries.
The bigness of microcredit. But first, let's do the numbers. Feeling blue in week two, we are. The Dow Industrials down 136 points, 0.9%, closed below 15,000, 14,936 to be precise. The NASDAQ surrendered 37 points, nearly 1%, 3770. The S&P 500 slipped 14 points, 0.8%, finished things at 1676. Financials led the Dow lower. American Express, JP Morgan Chase, and Goldman Sachs, one of the newest blue chips, all fell more than 1% today. Visa, also a newbie, debited 2%. Japan Airlines chose Airbus over Boeing over the weekend, and Boeing shares off 0.4% today. In Paris, Airbus parent EADS climbed more than 2%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.63%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. The Nobel Prize in Physics is announced. 193 individuals have received the award, two of them women. Alcoa is scheduled to report earnings. It's the company's first quarterly release since it was dropped from the Dow. And got a $100 bill in your wallet? Spend it. The Federal Reserve releases newly designed Benjamins. You want the latest, don't you? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's been something happening in Nashville, Tennessee the past couple of months that's gotten some attention. Homeless people have been finding places to live, getting off the streets at an unheard-of pace. And it's not new government grants or subsidized housing either. Largely private landlords have been giving the homeless a chance to prove themselves. Blake Farmer from WPLN in Nashville has that story.
Michelle Bratcher wouldn't be considered a model tenant by anyone.
But, I mean, I'm a recovering crack addict.
She did pills, too. And for the last year, this middle-aged woman slept on the streets and under highway overpasses.
Stayed up under a bush next to a church. Only thing I had.
And as the term chronically homeless would suggest, Bratcher has had multiple episodes in which she had no place to call home. But she caught a break in the last few months. A campaign by local housing agencies connected Bratcher to an apartment complex manager willing to discount the rent and look the other way on their typical lease terms.
I'm a convicted felon. Most places won't even take you.
Bratcher was locked up for a year. She's been out for nearly two.
And I'm not trying to go back. I'm getting me a place. I'm doing better. Just trying to keep my head above water, and it's working.
Bratcher attended a recent celebration with nearly 200 other people who've been placed into housing since June. The program is titled House Nashville, as in How is Nashville? Also there were landlords. Homeless advocates asked the city's largest property owners to set aside 1% of their units for the homeless and cut the rent to basically whatever they could pay from their government assistance check. Kirby Davis says foregoing the full market rate isn't a problem. It's what could go wrong.
You know, you have a duty as a landlord to your other residents, so you wonder, well, are they going to behave in a way that's going to alienate or scare or hurt my other residents? And you just got to take the leap of faith on that, I have to say. So far, we've been very lucky.
Davis's company, First Management Services, has nearly 2,500 units in Nashville. Roughly two dozen are now inhabited by formerly homeless tenants. Will Connolly heads Nashville's government agency over homelessness. He says with the help of social workers, he anticipates three-quarters can keep a roof over their heads. Some won't make it.
A certain percentage will fall out of their housing. They'll get evicted probably. I think if we provide the right amount of support, chances are the majority of folks can succeed.
Homeless advocates around the country are watching to see if private landlords will put up with these tenants long term. But they're also monitoring the program because it's a big test for an emerging recovery model called Housing First. The concept goes something like this. Homeless people shouldn't have to earn a place to stay by conquering an addiction or other underlying problem. Housing should be the first step to getting their lives stabilized. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Forget the billions of dollars we throw around when we talk about government spending and government debt. Think of a much smaller number, much smaller. And you've got yourself microcredit. Microfinance, as it's sometimes called, was pioneered by Muhammad Yunus back in the 1970s in Bangladesh. His first loan was for $26. In the years since, microcredit has been celebrated as a way for families and entrepreneurs in developing countries, often women, by the way, to climb out of poverty. Professor Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for his work, but he will be the first to tell you that the microcredit business could use some updates. Professor Yunus, it's good to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
I wonder maybe if we should start with the last time you were with us in 2006, and it was just before you had won the Nobel Prize.
Oh.
And I got to wondering this morning as I got ready to speak with you, if you think that prize has changed the face of microfinance, it's been what, 7 years now?
7 years now, yeah. Well, it has. It has. It has drawn a lot of attention. Today, we are building up the second generation of those families who are in microcredit so that their children do not remain illiterate. And we made sure that 100% of the children go to school, and they did. So this is transforming the whole family completely.
You know, it strikes me, you did this thing 35 years ago in Bangladesh mm-hmm. that was unheard of. It was extraordinary. And now here you are, and you've become the establishment.
Yes, because we have been doing it for long. But we continuously try to reinvent ourselves, add things to ourselves. So that makes me feel happy that, yes, what we can start in a small way in one country has a value and has an application and a concrete application in many other countries, rich countries and poor countries.
Have you heard of Kickstarter, that thing we have?
Yes, I heard about it. That's a good idea.
You like it? You like it?
I like it. Yes, I like it. They're trying to bring irrigation pumps and so on. Yeah, that's very good.
So it's okay that people have taken your idea and adapted it for their own person.
Yes, I would say initiative is good, but it can be misused. And when we talk about social business, somebody can use this, take this word and go in the wrong direction. But we always keep insisting a social business is a business to solve problems of the people, solve human problems. It's not about making money. If somebody is selling wristwatches, that's not a social business because you're not solving any problem.
This thing called microcredit or microfinance has become an amorphous enterprise, I suppose. And this is probably not a fair question since it's not a formal structure. But as you think about the future of microcredit, what tweaks do you have to make sure it survives another 30 or 35 years? What adjustments do you have to make?
First of all, it has to be poor-oriented, problem-solving-oriented financial institution. That's number one. Second, it needs a legal framework. Today, it doesn't have a legal home. Conventional banks have a legal home. You have a banking law. But nobody notices it's not only banking law. It is a banking law for creating banks for the rich. There is not a banking law to create bank for the poor. So we have to go around, find money to lend money to people. If we had a banking license, we don't have to worry about anybody. We just take deposits and lend money to people, as many people as we can get. So that's what the missing pieces that we have to make sure we fill it up.
Mohammed Yunus founded the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006 for his work in microfinance. Professor, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
President Obama sat down for an interview with the Associated Press a couple of days ago. There was talk of the shutdown and the debt limit in foreign affairs and whether or not the Washington Redskins ought to change their name. Perhaps one of the last things you might be expecting the president to be asked about at the moment is the NFL, but weigh in he did, in part because Native American groups and others have been after the team to rebrand for a while now. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Ever since high school, Mike Lewis has been thinking about the issue of Native American mascots.
My hometown is a place outside of Chicago called Naperville, where one of the high schools was the Redskins. They changed it to the Red Hawks. Then I went to the University of Illinois, and, you know, we know how that story's turned out with, you know, after years and years of pressure.
U of I retired its Native American mascot, Chief Alinawek, in 2007. Today, Lewis teaches business at Emory, where he co-authored a paper on the economics of Native American mascots.
Well, the key thing was we didn't find any real effect of going away from the Indian mascot.
Lewis's paper looked only at data from college sports. Alan Adamson is a branding expert with Landor, and he says that the short-term costs of rebranding an NFL team are not insignificant.
And they can range, depending on how fast you need to do it, from, you know, $5 million to $15 million, believe it or not.
Those costs include hiring a creative team to come up with a new logo and then slapping that logo on everything from uniforms to stationery. But Adamson says those costs would be offset by the fans who rush out to buy the old gear, now a collector's item, and by fans buying the new stuff. Kenneth Shropshire is a lawyer who specializes in sports business. He says the Redskins would have to share all that new revenue with the rest of the league.
The NFL has worked hard, probably harder than most leagues, at trying to keep those types of items centralized in terms of where the value goes.
But chances are there won't be a new logo anytime soon. The team's owner, Daniel Snyder, has vowed never to change the name. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, picking up on the idea of microcredit that I was talking about with Muhammad Yunus, although I don't think this really is what he had in mind.
Hello, my name is Frederick, and I work with Ticker, the wristwatch that counts down your life. I would like to talk to you about the day you are going to die.
You're going to think I'm making this up, but I'm not.
Ticker is a wristwatch that counts down your life from years to seconds and motivates you to make the right choices.
It's an actual Kickstarter campaign. They ask you a bunch of lifestyle questions and figure out how much time you have left, years, months, days, hours, minutes, and seconds.
So have the time of your life with Ticker, the death watch that makes every second count.
They're looking for $25,000, by the way.
Oh, and Ticker also tells you the time.
And they're like a third of the way there, believe it or not. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 136 points, about 0.9%, closed below 15,000, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ off 37 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 slipped 14 points. That is 0.8%, the death watch. That's what we just did. All right, our daily production team includes Lana Anwar, Bridget Bodner, and Raghu Manavalan. Millie Jefferson directs the show. Chow 2 is our digital producer. I'm Kaya Rizdal. There's more just like this tomorrow, right where it came from. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.